Africa Today.
The brutal war launched recently by the Israeli apartheid regime against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip galvanized African people who raised their voices in support of the oppressed people of Palestine. Numerous demonstrations were held across Africa to express solidarity with Palestinians and to condemn Israeli atrocities. South Africa's ruling African National Congress Youth League convener explains here on why they came out to express solidarity with Palestinians. Let's take a listen.
As the ANC Youth League, to pledge solidarity with the people of Palestine who have for decades been oppressed by the apartheid state of Israel. There is no difference in the manner in which the Israeli state is acting versus the manner in which the apartheid state used to act. Their latest attack on people who are praying is absolutely atrocious.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on Africa's support for Palestinians in Gaza who endured 12 days of heavy bombardment by the Israeli apartheid regime. African people have experienced colonialism, apartheid, racism, and discrimination perpetrated by Western countries, which currently support the Israeli regime, and therefore they have a natural affinity with Palestinians.
Africa slams Israeli apartheid crimes against Palestinians. The Israeli apartheid regime launched a bloody bombing campaign on Gaza on the 10th of May after harassing Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds and attempts to steal their lands in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the city. The occupying regime announced a unilateral ceasefire on the 21st of May. Atrocities perpetrated by the Israeli regime during this war, especially the killing of innocent women and children, ignited worldwide demonstrations, including spontaneous protest rallies in Africa. Despite attempts by authorities in some countries to stop the rallies, protesters came out in large numbers to express solidarity with Palestinians. This is one such rally in Kenya's capital, Nairobi.
Stand with my brothers and sisters in Palestine. I pray day and night that my sisters and brothers get peace, inshallah.
This is the police is arresting me. What did I do? I was protesting. Peaceful demonstration. Peaceful demonstration. Now that's what it is.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa told France 24 that the Israeli war on Gaza reminded him of the apartheid era in his own country.
The images that we've been seeing of people being prevented to move around, of their homes being destroyed, of people being driven out of their homes before they are bombed, of the Israeli soldiers manhandling people, brings back very terrible memories of our own history and apartheid, when people were forcibly moved from their homes, which they'd occupied for generations, when their homes were destroyed. So this, for us, is very close to our own suffering and apartheid.
For more on Africa's condemnation of recent Israeli regime crimes in the besieged Gaza Strip, we have contacted Maureen Kasuku, a member of Kenyans for Palestine, a grassroots network of internationalists standing in anti-colonial solidarity with the Palestinian people. Welcome to the program, Ms. Kasuku.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
We also have with us here today Hussein Khalid, who is the executive director of Haki Africa, a human rights organization based in Mombasa, Kenya. Thank you for joining us today, Mr. Khalid.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start off with Ms. Maureen Kasuku. Now, we've seen spontaneous demonstrations across Africa in solidarity with Palestinians and to condemn Israeli atrocities. What's your take on this?
What we're witnessing right now in Africa is African internationalism in action. Africans have always been the vanguard when it comes to resistance movements. We have always been at the forefront in condemning racist ideologies, including Zionism. We understand what it means to live under colonialism. We understand what it means to live under apartheid, and we understand the struggle for self-determination. That's why Africans all over the continent are standing in solidarity with the people of Palestine, because their struggles are also our struggles. So we understand what exactly they are going through, and that is why you see that the whole continent has stood up against Israeli apartheid in Palestine.
Anti-Israeli and pro-Palestinian rallies have been held in several African countries, including South Africa, Kenya, Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, Nigeria, Senegal, and Libya. In Kenya, apart from the capital Nairobi, protesters also gathered in the coastal city of Mombasa in a show of their support for Palestinians. They denounced Israeli regime crimes against the Palestinians. A protester in the city of Mombasa voices her support here for Palestinians.
My message today is we all need to stand with Palestine, and whatever is happening, we are all not safe for whatever is happening. So muhimu hapa, we just pass the message that humanity is the key.
Now, Mr. Khalid, can you tell us more about the rally ritual recently held in Kenya to condemn atrocities by Israeli apartheid regime in Gaza?
The rallies in Kenya, as you know, is the same case across the African continent, are spontaneous. It's groups of youth who decide to come out collectively in different cities, in different villages, and they feel they want to show their solidarity because they believe that this is a just cause. And the good thing about the protest is that they are multi-religious. So it's not just Muslims who are coming out. It's Muslims and Christians and Hindus who believe that justice must prevail anywhere in the world.
The occupation of Palestine by the Israeli apartheid regime reminds many in Africa of their own struggle during the colonial era. Addressing an African Union summit last year, South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa even compared the so-called peace plan for Palestine being pushed by the U.S. to the Bantustan system, which was implemented by the apartheid regime in his own country.
I'd like to say, with regards to the U.S.-inspired plan for the Palestinians, that as I listened to it and as I read everything that's written about it, it brought to mind a horrible history that we as South Africa have gone through. That the apartheid regime once imposed a Bantustan system on the people of South Africa without consultation with them and with all the oppressive elements that that plan had. As I listened to the Arab League and as I listened to our colleagues from Palestine, it sounds like this plan, one, has not been consulted with all the people that matter, especially the Palestinians, and it sounds like a Bantustan type of construct.
Well, we had the South African President Ramaphosa comparing the situation in Palestine under Israeli apartheid regime to that of South Africa during the apartheid regime. Now, Mr. Khalid, what are some of the commonalities between the current struggle for the liberation of Palestine and struggle for independence in Africa?
I believe in Africa we have gone through a similar experience. Many years back, decades ago, our forefathers fought for the freedom of our countries. And so seeing the same thing happening in Palestine, I believe we can draw parallels with what we went through. And that is why you are seeing spontaneous protests and demonstrations across the African continent in support of the Palestinian cause and to call for the end of oppression by the Israeli government. Here in Kenya, the Palestinian support movement is strong. We have seen protests and demonstrations in major cities, including in Nairobi and Mombasa. And many people are out there tweeting, using social media, Facebook, Instagram, to send their message of solidarity to Palestinians.
The African Union Commission Chairperson, Moussa Faki Mohammed, has strongly condemned the Israeli regime forces' violent attacks against worshippers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and bombing of the Gaza Strip. Mohammed reiterated the continued AU support for the Palestinian people in their legitimate quest for an independent and sovereign state.
Now, Maureen, African Union has condemned Israeli regime atrocities in Palestine. Now, is condemnation enough? And what further action do you think should be taken by the AU in support of Palestine?
I don't think condemnation is enough, because often these African governments offer lip service to the people of Palestine, but then continue to maintain cozy relationships with Israel. They purchase weapons from Israel, they purchase surveillance material from Israel, and these weapons and these cyber espionage tools are meant to maintain repressive regimes in Africa. So they give money to the Israeli regime, and this money is used to strengthen the Israeli regime in occupied Palestine. So condemnation is not enough. I think African governments should cut bilateral ties with Israel.
Well, it remains to be seen if African countries will listen to the people and take tangible action in boycotting the apartheid regime in Israel.
Kenya, Niger, and Tunisia are three African countries that are currently non-permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. Citizens of these countries expect their countries to take a firm stand in condemning Israeli atrocities in Gaza.
Now, Mr. Khalid, what role can these African countries, which are members of the UN Security Council, play in support of Palestinians?
I believe that my country, Kenya, together with Nigeria and Tunisia, who are presently non-permanent members of the UN Security Council, can do much more to ensure Palestinian people live in peace. As African countries who have gone through colonial rule for many years, I believe that Kenya, Nigeria, and Tunisia should push the United Nations to send a peacekeeping mission in Palestine to ensure that no more rights or violations of any kind of Palestinians continues unabated. We believe that as African countries, we can make a bigger voice, we can have a bigger voice in what is happening in Palestine, and we can demand for accountability by the Israeli troops.
Thanks a lot for that, Mr. Khalid, and I'm sure you meant they are Niger and not Nigeria.
Africa slams Israeli apartheid crimes against Palestinians.
Now, in a country like Morocco, despite the kingdom's move to normalize ties with the Israeli apartheid regime, the masses are clearly with the oppressed nation of Palestine. Now, what message does this send to the monarchy in these North African states?
I think that Morocco's monarchy is clearly disconnected to its people. We know for sure that Morocco has had a number of protests where the people have come out openly to condemn the atrocities that are committed against the Palestinians and to demand that Israel immediately ends its aggression on the Palestinian people. To see that the government of Morocco remains quiet, remains silent, even when the large majority of its population are standing in solidarity with Palestinians, is a big embarrassment to the monarchy. It clearly shows there is a disconnect, and I think it's about time for the people of Morocco to consider whether the kingdom is helping them as a country to move forward. I believe that at every given point in time, there comes a time when the people have to decide.
South Africans vividly remember the Sharpeville massacre as an event that marked a turning point against the apartheid regime. During this gruesome massacre in March 1960, the apartheid regime forces gunned down 250 black protesters. The recent war waged on Gaza by the apartheid regime in Tel Aviv has been compared by some to the Sharpeville massacre, which eventually led to the downfall of the white minority rule in South Africa.
Now, Mr. Khalid, the brutal Israeli war on Gaza has been likened to the Sharpeville massacre during the apartheid era in South Africa. Now, this massacre was one of the events that triggered the eventual downfall of the South African apartheid regime. Now, do you see the same fate befalling the Israeli apartheid regime?
I am a human rights activist, and I know that oppression never lasts forever. Any other day, justice will always prevail. And we know for sure that freedom in Palestine is coming. This is something, as a human rights activist, as a human rights defender, we know that wherever there are atrocities, it can never last forever. We believe that this is the beginning of an end to this oppression, and we believe that all we need is the world to stand together against oppression. All we need is the people of Palestine to remain steadfast. All we need is the people of Africa to remember that they were in the same situation just a few decades away, so that they can stand together and champion for the rights of Palestinians.
Now, momentum has also been gaining for the international movement to boycott, divest from, and sanction Israel, known as BDS, in support of Palestinian national liberation. A similar tactic of international boycott played a crucial role in delegitimizing the South African apartheid system.
Recently, the labor movements joined the South African BDS coalition at the Durban harbor to support dock workers who refused to offload cargo from an Israeli container ship in a stand against the regime's atrocities in Palestine.
Dozens of South African dock workers picketed at a port in Durban on Friday as they showed their support for Palestinians. The action comes after they had attempted to boycott offloading cargo from an Israeli ship. The Zim Shanghai vessel arrived at the port on Thursday, while unions and workers were negotiating with the country's transport authority to block exports coming from Israel.
The international boycott of South Africa during the apartheid era was instrumental in the eventual downfall of this regime. Will the BDS movement also be instrumental in the collapse of the Israeli apartheid regime?
Yes, I do believe that the BDS movement worldwide will play a huge role in the collapse of the Israeli regime in occupied Palestine. The Kenyans for Palestine movement has its own BDS strategy, which seems to be working very well.
South African anti-apartheid leader Nelson Mandela and his party, the African National Congress, remained on a United States terrorism watch list until 2008. Former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher dismissed the African National Congress, ANC, as a typical terrorist organization and refused to back sanctions against the South African government that pursued the notorious policy of apartheid.
Now, Mr. Khalid Hussein, Western countries branded Nelson Mandela a terrorist, and even his party, ANC, was listed as a terrorist organization. History is repeating itself in Palestine as Hamas, Islamic Jihad resistance movements, and their leaders have been branded as terrorists by Western countries. Are you surprised?
We as Kenya, we know that our forefathers who fought for our independence were initially called terrorists by the colonialists. As you've rightfully mentioned, Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress, ANC party, which fought for the independence of South Africa, were equally called terrorists by the colonialists. So this and the Western government. So this is a trend. History is full of these examples. And we believe that anyone who is standing firm and fighting for the rights of their people and fighting for an end to human rights violations is a freedom fighter. So I believe that people should continue in the struggle to fight for human rights. Palestinians should continue to struggle to fight for their independence, and history will judge them right.
In the Senegalese capital, Dakar, thousands of protesters took part in a demonstration to lend support to oppressed Palestinians. One interesting aspect of this rally in Dakar was the participation of Palestinians who were forced by the Israeli apartheid regime to leave their homeland and have now been granted asylum in Senegal. Let's take a listen.
It's really heartwarming. It's really amazing.
At
the same time, I'm communicating to my family back home. See, a lot of people are coming out for you. It makes them stronger. It makes them, like, more patient. You know? It's amazing.
It's just something great. It's just something unbelievable. I'm so glad. I'm so proud of the Senegalese people. And I know how they love Palestine. And I know how they love Al-Aqsa.
Khalid, our last question to you. Now, after the mass pro-Palestinian protests in Africa, should we expect African governments to pile more pressure on the Israeli apartheid regime and force it to end its occupation of Palestine?
For African countries that have lived through this kind of experiences, it needs to be more than just condemning the actions that we are seeing presently. We as human rights defenders, we as civil society actors, are pushing our government to do more than just condemn. We want to see action taken. We want to see our government standing up and defending freedom of any person, whether it's Palestinians or anyone in the world. These kinds of atrocities are not supposed to be happening. And that is why we are saying African countries need to do more, because we know what these kinds of atrocities mean. Our forefathers have been through that, and we expect them to do more, to do better.
In Cape Town, South Africa, the rally in support for Palestine was organized by Al-Quds Foundation and several pro-Palestinian organizations and political parties.
Well, mostly I stand here as a father. My son today is turning 4 years old, Mandela Ikram Mandel. And to continuously witness children in Palestine being shot in the back, being put in prison, it really pains our hearts as fathers, as parents, and also as citizens in the Republic of South Africa that have witnessed such brutalities in our past. And we are here today as a family with my wife, my father-in-law, as well as my mother-in-law, to say that we will not rest until we see a free Palestine in our lifetime. And we will speak against the brutality that is meted out against innocent children and women in Palestine. And that is why we are here united as a family today, to charge forward with what Madiba once said, that our freedom is incomplete until the Palestinians are free.
A powerful statement there by Mandla Mandela, who has vowed that he will not rest until Palestine is free. Now, Maureen, you have the last word today in our program. Do you see total emancipation and freedom of Palestine in the near future?
I just want to urge all Africans at home and abroad to stand in solidarity with the people of Palestine, because their struggles are our struggles too. This is African internationalism at play. We must stand against apartheid, we must stand against Zionism, and we will march forward towards the sovereignty of Palestine and all African nations.
Well, we have seen how recent rallies in Africa are a manifestation of Africa's overwhelming support for the liberation of Palestine and condemnation of the Israeli regime. Well, and that wraps it up for this edition of Africa Today. As always, it was great having you, and don't forget to drop us a line through our social media handles. Goodbye for now.
Islam smashes joint Arab-Israelite attack. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Today is a memorable day in history. It is the anniversary of an immortal event that made Islam triumphant over an Arab-Israelite plot. The enemies intended to end the life and mission of the Seal of Messengers and wipe out the few faithful Muslims from the face of the earth, with the help of the fifth column in Medina, that is, the hypocrites whose hearts were devoid of faith while outwardly they professed Islam. The Holy Quran mentions this crucial happening in the Surah Al-Ahzab, which means the Confederates or the Allies, that is, the pagan Arabs and the Israelites, who besieged the city of Medina with an overwhelming force. But God Almighty routed them with winds and a sandstorm in what became known as the Battle of the Ditch, in reference to the digging of a wide trench around the city as a barrier to invasion, an unprecedented practice in Arabia. The Muslims dug a ditch, which the disbelievers were unable to cross, and eventually the enemy retreated in disarray. This is mentioned in the Holy Quran, in order to remind the believers of God's goodness to them, so that they may obey divine commandments, including proper conduct towards Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and his household, or Ahlul Bayt, blessed household, peace be upon them. The hypocrites are warned of the consequences if they do not stop their bad behavior. The truly faithful are promised a great reward for the sacrifices in the way of God. The ayahs of the Holy Quran undoubtedly refer to one of the greatest events in the history of Islam, when the person who stands to this day as the model for every true believer and whose faith in God Almighty and the Prophet single-handedly brought victory to Islam and humanitarian values. Please stay with us to listen to a summarized account of the Battle of the Ditch and the heroic exploit of this champion of Islam who defeated the joint plot of the Arabs and the Israelites. Will deal with this cur. Thus said the last and greatest prophet, whom the Almighty Creator has sent as mercy unto the whole creation, and regarding whom the Holy Quran, after lauding his limitless patience, says in Ayah 4 of Surah Al-Qalam, indeed you possess a great character. The use of the word cur here does not refer to any canine breed, but, as is clear by the tone of the phrase, it is a disdainful remark for someone whose behavior has made him worse than a rabid dog. This phrase was not used by a person unacquainted with ethics or the etiquette of speech. These are not the words of any impatient and haughty soul unable to control his emotions or tongue. In fact, it is the expression of the man regarding whom the Lord Most High tells us in the opening ayahs of Surah Najm in the Holy Quran, your companion has neither gone astray nor gone amiss, nor does he speak out of his own desire. It is just a revelation that is revealed to him. In view of this fact, it is thus clear that the cur referred to by the last and greatest messenger of God had committed a cardinal sin and deserved capital punishment. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was asking his companions to mete out justice that the cur deserved. Those still in the dark about the identity of the cur and the unpardonable crime he committed ought to know the significance of the 17th of Shawwal in Islamic history. On this day, in the year 5 AH, a formidable 10,000-strong combined force of Arab infidels and Israelites approached the city of Medina with the intention of killing the Holy Prophet and obliterating Islam. To the surprise of the Arab and Israelite confederates, a ditch blocked their assault on the city. It was a new tactic in warfare in Arabia, thanks to the suggestion of a new companion of the Holy Prophet, Salman al-Farsi, or the Persian, who was from Iran. The siege of the city of Medina prolonged and the patience of the besiegers began to wear thin, the pagan Arab leader, Abu Sufyan, in consultation with his Israelite accomplices, thought that the veritable giant, Amr ibn Abdawad, along with a handful of roughnecks, could deliver the coup de grace to Muslims, since the fifth column in Medina was also impatiently awaiting the end of the Holy Prophet and Islam. The arrogant Arab and his ignorant band leapt across the ditch at its narrowest point and challenged the Muslims to individual combat, as was the custom. Amr ibn Abdawad, the infidel, blasphemously thrust his spear in the Prophet's tent while grunting his challenge, fully aware that the hypocrites among the Muslims will discourage and dishearten the few faithful by praising his physical strength and brutality of character. It is now clear why the Holy Prophet of Peace called Amr ibn Abdawad a cur, and why he gave the verdict for capital punishment. In other words, anyone, even a self-styled Muslim, who dares to desecrate the sanctity of the residence, however temporary, of a representative of God, is worse than a rabid dog, and should be dispatched to the bowels of hell. Where is Islamic conscience these days? A few years ago, a terrorist outfit masquerading as Muslims had destroyed the blessed tomb of Prophet Jonah or Prophet Yunus in the Iraqi city of Mosul. With the arms and money supplied by the Wahhabi cult, which in 1925 had committed the sacrilege of desecrating and demolishing the graves of the elite of Islam at the Jannat al-Baqi cemetery in the city of Medina, especially the holy shrine housing the resting place of four of the 12 infallible heirs of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon them. Now, speaking about hypocrisy, the Almighty informs us in the Holy Quran about the hypocrites who were among the Holy Prophet's companions during the Battle of the Ditch, in ayahs 12 to 15 of Surah Ahzab in the Holy Quran. And when the hypocrites were saying, as well as those in whose hearts is a sickness, Allah and His Prophet did not promise us anything except delusion. And when a group of them said, O people of Yathrib, this is not a place for you, so go back. And a group of them sought the Prophet's permission, saying, Our homes lie exposed to the enemy, although they were not exposed. They only sought to flee. Had they been invaded from its flanks, and had they been asked to apostatize, they would have done so with only a mild hesitation, though they had certainly pledged to Allah before that they would not turn their backs to flee, and pledges given to Allah are accountable. Up then, when no one dared to meet the challenge of Amr ibn Abdulwahd the Kur, the Prophet's cousin and son-in-law, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, calmly rose and volunteered to finish off the task. The Holy Prophet sent him to fight as the embodiment of all faith, saying, "Forth to confront the embodiment of all infidelity." The rest is history. Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, after inviting Amr ibn Abdulwahd to Islam and receiving a negative reply, sent him to the netherworld, but not before allowing him to renew the life and death combat, because the cowardly infidel had hurled to the ground, had dared to spit at his opponent. That was the reason Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, hailed Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib's selfless feat that was solely for the sake of God, and without personal emotions becoming involved in the combat. The Holy Prophet of Islam said, "The stroke of Ali on the day of the ditch is greater than the worship of all mankind and jinn."
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I would like to begin this episode with a question. Who was the very first person who rebelled against Allah? Who was he? You all know. The first person who transgressed and crossed the limits was Satan. He refused to submit to Allah. He rebelled him when, of course, Allah wanted him to obey him. But he rebelled. Shaitan was a good creature in the beginning. He was worshipping Allah. He was submissive. But when Allah put him to a serious test by asking him to show his respect to Adam, he stubbornly refused. He said, "Because I am much better than Adam. Who the heck is Adam? I'm not going to bow to Adam." خَلَقْتَنِ مِن نَار وَخَلَقْتَهُ مِن تِين. So Shaitan was stubborn, Shaitan was selfish, and Shaitan was proud of himself, because he was proud of having been created from fire, while man, insan, was created from mud, from clay. Okay, he was saying, "Okay, my race is white and his race is black." That's what we are saying nowadays. That's what we see, at least in the world. Some people say, "I am European, I'm so and so. I'm not going to respect someone who is poor, who comes from so and so country." So it is all because of selfishness, because of arrogance, because of stubbornness, and because of pride. It's all because of this that he says, "I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that. Shaitan was very much, yes, like this. Shaitan did not submit to Allah and he did not obey Allah because he was proud. Allah the Exalted, the Almighty, says the true essence, the true act of worship, ibadah, is that when you are willing to submit to Allah, that's the main essence of ibadah. Worshipping Allah is all about submitting to Allah. Every cell in your body yearns Him, submits to Him, and worships Him. There is a verse in the Quran which says, "Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alamin." Say that my prayer, my rituals, my life, and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. So that's all about ibadah. Is all about submission. Okay. Not only your actions, your feelings, your aspirations, your sentiments must be directed to Allah. If you love someone, you must love him for the sake of Allah. If you hate something, you should hate for the sake of Allah. Every cell in your body submits to Allah. And that's what submission is about. That's what the religion of Islam is about. Religion has two dimensions, two sides. One is the exterior, which is very visible. Everyone can see the exterior. What is the exterior of faith? Prayers, the fasting, when you don't eat and drink, the Hajj, the charity that you give, and the jihad. These are the exterior of the religion, the outward aspect of the religion. Okay? But the interior of Islam and the essence of Islam is the submission to Allah. The inner faith and belief in Islam, which is invisible to the eyes, that is the true essence. The true essence of Islam is submission. And you have to believe that when it comes to Allah, you are nothing but subservient to Allah, the Almighty. You submit to Allah willfully, truly, utterly, and completely. And you are subservient to Allah with all your heart, body, and soul.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Man reaches a degree of belief where he declares his nothingness before Allah. That is the true faith. That is the true faith. This is how you measure your faith. This is a scale on which you put your faith and you measure it. Okay? And you see whether you really have faith. And if you have faith, do you have 50% faith, complete faith, or incomplete faith? Or you have no faith at all? Okay? In fact, this is the essence. This is the meaning of love. When you love someone, you are prepared to do everything for him. You're willing to do everything for him. If he tells you to call him before going to bed, you call him. If he tells you to call him every 30 minutes, you call him. If he tells you to pick him from the street, you would do so. If he tells you, wait for me in the street in the cold, you will definitely do it, as people do it. We can see it. If he tells you to wait for him in the road and it's raining, you will do that. You will never say no to him because you love that person. Prophet Sulaiman saw an ant in the desert, carrying some dust from one end to another. Sulaiman, who had the ability of communicating with animals and insects, said, "What are you doing there?" The ant said, "I'm carrying dust from this side to the other side." He said, "Why are you doing this?" She said, "I am in love. I am in deep love with someone who asked me to do so, and I'm just listening to him." Sulaiman said to her, "But the dust here is too much, and this is a big mountain of dust. You will not be able to carry all the dust even if you leave the life of Noah. Are you going to spend all your life doing this? You are going to die soon or late. You cannot do that." She said to him, "Ya Sulaiman, dying in the way of love and in the line of duty towards someone you love is much better and comforting for you. Yes, even if I die, it does not matter because I'm dying for him." Sulaiman received the message that even in our death, we have to die for our Lord, the glorified. قُلْ إِنَّ صَلَاتِي وَنُسُكِي وَمَحْيَايَ وَمَمَاتِ لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. Of course, not only your activities and prayers, but your death should also be for him. Your life and death, your beginning and your end should be for him. That is the true essence of faith. We live for Allah and completely submit to him. فَلَا وَرَبَّكَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ حَتَّى يُحَكِّمُوكَ فِي مَا شَجَرَ بَيْنَهُمْ ثُمَّ لَا يَجِدُوا فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ حَرَجًا مِمَّا قَضَيْتَ وَيَسَلِّمُوا تَسْلِيمًا. But no, by your Lord, they do not believe in reality until they make you a judge of that which has become a matter of disagreement among them. And this is the translation of the verse. And then do not find any straightness in their hearts as to what you have decided, and submit with entire submission. And that's the end of this episode. Inshallah, we will carry on this discussion. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is on me. All I need, it's all I need. It's all I need. All I need. All I need. Oh. All I need to be all I need, and I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The recent bombing and leveling of Gaza by the U.S. financed and supplied Israeli regime military is just the latest example of the devastating toll exacted by American weapons transfers in these years, says William Hartung, author, in an article titled, "When it comes to the tools of death and destruction, no one tops the U.S." Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. Months into Joe Biden's term, the president's early pledge to rein in damaging arms deals are already eroding. The first blow was the news that the administration would indeed move forward with a $23 billion arms package to the UAE, including F-35 combat aircraft, armed drones, and a staggering $10 billion worth of bombs and missiles. The decision was ill-advised on several fronts, most notably because of that country's role in Yemen's brutal war. There, despite scaling back its troops on the ground, it continues to arm, train, and finance 90,000 militia members, including extremist groups with links to the Yemen-based Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The UAE has also backed armed opposition forces in Libya in violation of a United Nations embargo, launched drone strikes that killed scores of civilians, and cracked down on dissidents at home and abroad. It regularly makes arbitrary arrests and uses torture. If arming the UAE isn't a case of checking our values at the door, it's not clear what it is. Certainly, the new U.S. administration has allowed U.S. government, personnel, and contractors to help maintain the effectiveness of Saudi Air Force, and so has continued to enable ongoing airstrikes in Yemen that are notorious for killing civilians. The Biden team has also failed to forcefully pressure the Saudis to end their blockade of that country, which United Nations agencies have determined could put 400,000 Yemeni children at risk of death by starvation in the next year. While Biden's early actions have undermined promises to take a different approach to arms sales, the story isn't over. Questions have been raised about what arms should go to Saudi Arabia and reforms that would strengthen Congress' role in blocking objectionable arms transfers are being pressed by at least some members of the House and the Senate. the Trump administration significantly loosened restrictions and regulations on the export of a wide range of guns, including semi-automatic firearms and sniper rifles. As a result, such exports surged in 2020 with record sales of more than 175,000 military rifles and shotguns. In a distinctly deregulatory move, Trump's team moved sales of deadly firearms from the jurisdiction of the State Department, which had a mandate to vet any such deals for possible human rights abuses, to the Commerce Department, whose main mission was simply to promote the export of just about anything. Trump's reforms also eliminated the need to pre-notify Congress on any major firearms sales, making it far harder to stop deals with repressive regimes. As he pledged to do during his presidential campaign, Biden could reverse Trump's approach without even seeking congressional approval. Beyond the slightest doubt, a major or perhaps even major obstacle to reforming arms sales policies and practices is the weapons industry itself. That includes major contractors like Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics that produce fighter planes, bombs, armored vehicles, and other major weapon systems, as well as firearms makers like SICK SOAR. Raytheon stands out in this crowd because of its determined efforts to push through bomb sales to Saudi Arabia and the deep involvement of its former or future employees with the U.S. government. A former Raytheon lobbyist, Charles Faulkner, worked in the Trump State Department's Office of Legal Counsel and was involved in deciding that Saudi Arabia was not, it was, intentionally bombing civilians in Yemen. He then supported declaring a bogus emergency to arm through the sale of bombs and of aircraft supports to Saudi Arabia. Raytheon has indeed insinuated itself in the halls of government in a fashion that should be deeply troubling given by the minimalist standards of the 21st century military-industrial complex. Former Trump Defense Secretary Mark Esper was Raytheon's chief in-house lobbyist before joining the administration, while current Biden Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin served on Raytheon's board of directors. While Austin has pledged to recuse himself from decisions involving the company, it's a pledge that will prove difficult to verify. Arms sales are big business. The caps are a must for the top weapons makers. Lockheed Martin gets roughly one quarter of its sales from foreign governments and Raytheon 5% of its revenue from Saudi sales. American jobs allegedly tied to weapons exports are always the selling point for such dealings, but in reality, they have been greatly exaggerated. At most, arms sales account for just more than 0.1% of U.S. employment. Many such sales, in fact, involved outsourcing production in whole or in part to recipient nations, reducing the jobs impact here significantly. Though it's seldom noted, virtually any other form of spending creates more jobs than weapons production. In addition, exporting green technology products would create far larger global markets for U.S. goods. Should the government ever decide to support them in anything like the way it supports the arms industry? Given what's at stake for them economically, Raytheon